Are non-linguistic animals conscious? Are they knowers? Do they know things? Do they plan for the future? What about bees when they navigate a forest? Do they know what they're doing, or are they automata? These are some of the questions that I put to Dr. Carlos Montemayor in our sit-down conversation in this episode of the Parker's Pensies podcast. Now, this is a podcast where we explore all the deepest ideas in philosophy, theology, nature, and life. I love thinking about cool stuff, so come think with me. This episode was recorded live in person at Florida Atlantic University as we were celebrating the opening of the Center for the Future Mind at MindFest 2023. I'm looking forward to bringing you guys a lot more episodes, a lot more content from that inaugural conference. So be looking for that. The audio may be a little bit quiet, maybe a little bit off. I jacked up the audio recording. That's my bad, but it's not going to happen again because I got some new equipment, so don't worry about it. You may have to turn this up a little bit, but leave me a like and all that stuff and trick the algorithms into thinking this is a good video anyways. Dr. Carlos Montemayor is awesome. He is an expert in the field. He's a really generous, cool guy. You're going to love this episode. If you guys want to support the podcast, Patreon or YouTube members, you can find the links in the description, wherever you're getting this podcast at. So without further ado, let's jump in with Dr. Carlos Montemayor.
So, Carlos, thanks so much for coming on the podcast, man.
This is great. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, definitely. Can you tell the audience where you are currently working right now?
I'm currently at San Francisco State University. I've been teaching there philosophy for the last almost 12 years. Yeah, I'm a philosopher of mind and psychology, working currently on artificial intelligence. My PhD is from Rutgers.
So good, yeah. We talked a little bit about that, and we had some of the Rutgers people on the podcast, so it's a Rutgers-friendly podcast.
Yeah.
Can you talk about a little bit of your dissertational work? What'd you do that on?
Yeah, it was on the perception of time. So I originally was working with Zenon Bulichin on multiple object tracking,
yeah,
and his vision lab. And there a big question is, what are the built-in requirements for perception of space, at least visual space? Of course, that applies to cross-modal space. And then I became really interested in the similar questions at the time, what are the built-in,
yeah,
sort of assumptions of our perception of time. And so I ended up doing sort of like a epistemology heavy way of approaching the topic.
Oh, cool.
So my advisor was Alvin Goldman, but I read a lot of Animal Cognition with Randy Galistel, how animals perceive time through their circadian rhythms and through some other mechanisms they have for navigation. So that was my entry point into like animal cognition.
Yeah.
Because with the visual stuff, most of the experiments are on humans, and human vision is very well studied, very well understood.
Right.
But time perception, it turns out, is very well understood, and there's a lot of paradigms that are studied, but also a lot of animal cognition,
yeah,
literature is on time perception. So
yeah,
that was a.
So good. And that brought into you brought that into your the panel discussion yesterday about animal consciousness. And for the audience, we have we're here at MindFest, and that should be known in the introduction. But there was a panel on infant consciousness, animal,
yeah,
consciousness, and then like mini brains and petri dish type consciousness,
yeah,
as well. We talked after your talk about time binding and animals' perception, like you just mentioned. Are you familiar with Mortimer Adler at all? He's a popular philosopher of the last century, like a popularizer type dude.
Yeah, I think I've heard of him, but I'm not.
Yeah, sure. Well, so he talks about the uniqueness of humans, and it's dated, right? It just came, mm-hmm, out like the 90s. But he said that one of the unique aspects of humans is that we are what he called time binders, that we think of our past selves, our past societal history, and then we can also think of in the future. And wonder, do animals time bind like that? Do animals, can you help us with animal perception of,
yeah,
time?
Yeah, so animal perception of time is very complicated. It's a very complicated issue. Insects use it to navigate complex environments. They don't have a very long lives,
yeah,
but their perception of space and time is very robust. They have a sense of numerosity, for example. They can count up to a certain number. They can perceive things like the rate of change of an environment, which is a function of time and change. Time and number, really, yeah, rate. And of course, you know, the big research there is there are circadian rhythms at different stages. There are other ultradian, infradian rhythms that determine how even plants track time. And so I would say that life as such is a time-binding mechanism, because,
okay,
we depend on cycles.
Right.
The reproduction cycle is time-bound. The hibernation cycle is time-bound.
Yeah.
There are animal clocks that are very precise throughout across nature. And of course, the most important natural cycle is the circadian cycle.
Yeah, sure.
For our cycle. This is a cycle that turns out to be super important for insect navigation. And as you move on to other animals that have more robust kinds of memory, and especially sophisticated kinds of episodic and semantic memory,
yeah,
they start looking a lot like us. Right? They can label events really precisely.
Okay.
They can calendarize their life. They can, for example, scrub jays, birds, corvids, have these very interesting capacities to, for example, know where they hit a certain kind of food,
sure,
an insect or a worm,
yeah,
versus a piece of walnut.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I've heard about this. And like squirrels will do that. Although, from what I've heard, they bite off certain like nuts so they don't grow, but other ones they don't need to, so they don't bite off the tips and stuff like that.
Yeah.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
So these animals with larger memories, they can actually bind events not only with respect to the cycle of 24 hours, which is what,
yeah,
how most people understand insects, right? Like they're time bound, they're kind of stuck in the present, or, and their cycle is very, it's like really like they're trapped in the 24 hour cycle,
yeah,
like Groundhog Day, I guess. but these animals are not. These animals are they travel in time to the extent,
yeah,
that they can plan to revisit certain places in the future, also have a very robust representation of the past,
yeah,
at least in the sense that they know where they hid information. Corvids even know if other birds saw them hide the food, then they remember that they changed the location.
Wow.
So they have a very good memory for location, for the time they hid the food, but also the identity of the food they,
yeah,
they hid. And so, for example, corvids are also very good at knowing the rate of decay of the food that they. So
wow.
they would visit the worm
because they have an idea of how long it would take to decay.
Yeah. So I mean, this is experiments that show that they're more that you can predict that they will visit a food that is, let's say, not going to be very good in 2 or 3 days, than something like a knot or something like that would stay better.
Yeah.
So these animals, they're not the typical animal. I mean, we would say they have some kind of memory system that is robust enough, at least semantic and episodic memory of even if it's rudimentary, they are intelligent.
Yeah.
We don't really typically think of them as, okay, they're kind of like conscious like us, but they do have this complex intelligence. And they bind events much more cognitively than insects or plants. So plants are kind of time-bound to the cycles of nature. They're plants literally are bound to the soil,
yeah, right,
and to their metabolic needs. And they need their most important need is to consume light. So they're kind of bound by natural cycles.
Yeah.
Insects are less bound because they can represent the environment. Binds events in a different way. So, for example,
yeah,
they can bind an event that is like, okay, I'm going to navigate towards the hive, and then I'm going to scout for food.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit more complicated.
Yeah. That one blew my mind yesterday when you talked about bees navigating forests.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, I never thought that was a big deal until you said that. I was like, wait, we have such a hard time navigating forests.
Yeah.
And so maybe it's like a scent thing or something. Maybe they're automaton. But just trying to think through, like, that's pretty wild. You mentioned the wobble dance and stuff like that that they do as well, but. Yeah, sorry. So
one way of thinking about this is that the even something as simple, but a nervous system as simple as the nervous system of a bee is already capable of this very non-trivial task, right?
Yeah.
Like navigating a forest, the waggle dance is kind of an interpretive, communicative act, which are with something like a communicative intention.
Yeah.
Like there's food there. Here's the orientation. It's not like the dance is interpreted in that way.
Sure.
So they're less bound. I mean, they're binding events to their cognitive capacities, but they're doing that in a way that is a little bit more abstract from what the environment is imposing on them.
Right.
And then birds are like the next step, where they're really working with cognitive categorizations of the environment, timing events in a way that is not bound by the 24-hour cycle, and having this longer representation of time. That then, in the case of humans, that's where things get tricky. We have the most abstract representation of time, or probably of all species, right? Sure. Because we think the past, we can conceive of the past going back to infinity, and the future back to, I mean, on to infinity.
Yeah.
We know that that's not true because of some physical properties of the universe, but we have this very interesting capacity to memorialize, historicize the past, very deep into the past, and project into the future. And so this leads some people to think that this capacity to time travel across our lives and narrate ourselves is unique to humans.
Mm-hmm.
And that we can bind time not only in terms of events that are important to us and that are biologically important or external to us, but we actually narrate events in a way that are meaningful to us.
Yeah.
So we create meaningful narratives out of this capacity for narration. And many people think, or some people at least think, language is needed for that.
But so the language, I should mention again that the panel was on non-linguistic animals and non-linguistic things that are conscious or thought to be conscious, and different ways to tell whether they are or not. And the linguistic one's a really big thing for me. I've studied a lot of Don Davidson, and he just hammers that point that you need language in order to have...
He has this paper, Seeing Through Language.
And Rational Animals, and all sorts of his triangulation argument, which my audience should know by now, you guys, if you listen. But I wonder about if we're talking about animal cognition, or just cognition in non-linguistic animals and representation, and are we speaking like analogically about this? Like Davidson has this famous thought experiment about a dog barking at a tree.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, you and I can say that dog barking at the wrong tree because we saw the squirrel go in the other tree. But the dog, it doesn't seem like he has propositional thoughts
mm-hmm.
that have like propositional content because he doesn't have a language. And we can say squirrel, but maybe he thinks it's that brown thing or that smelly thing, or the aspect problem comes up. Like, so what do we mean when we say that animals have like knowledge or time-bound knowledge?
Well, that's a really tough question. I mean, in epistemology, Davidson and other thinkers were, many of them were interested in the distinction between cognition and perception.
Yeah, sure.
The boundary between what we largely call cognition, the manipulation of propositional content through concepts, and then basic perception that some people think, well, it's either non-conceptual, quasi-propositional, or analog in the sense that you don't really have contents that are specified by sharp ways of building them through propositional content that have accuracy conditions.
Yeah.
They're rather like fuzzy, like So that was a big aspect of what Davidson and other philosophers were doing, the sort of conceptual non-conceptual distinction. Animals are generally thought of as non-conceptual thinkers. Many people think that humans also have non-conceptual capacities. That's, for example, our motor control system, our capacities to navigate the environment, our perception of time. Time is very interesting because we represent time linguistically, for sure, through counterfactuals, right? Like, if I arrive at the meeting on time, then I can have lunch at this other time, right? So, or we can think of time as, you know, calendarically, right? Like, this event happens in this day, and you know. But we also just have a sense of time, which doesn't seem to depend on linguistic concepts or characterization. So, for example, I can sense that something is urgent, or I can have an urgent need and experience that as time through my metabolic capacities.
Yeah.
Or I can sleep and then feel that I overslept. Or I can be at a, this is a, the famous example of the stopwatch, the so-called stopwatch, which is not a circadian rhythm, but like literally like a stopwatch that you initiate and you stop. And there's a correlate in our neural system that is related to attention that we use. For example, the typical example is you're at a stoplight and people are very good at knowing when the light is going to turn green. There's cues, of course, but the people are just good at timing short events.
And so some would say that might not be, that may be an example of non-conceptual.
Because here you seem to be representing an analog magnitude as such,
okay,
without categorizing it as like seconds or milliseconds or using a specific metric system. And so that's one aspect of the question. The other is, non-linguistic animals are thinkers and knowers to the extent that they are, this is an externalist characterization of what they're doing, but you can use an internalist, I'll use one in a second, but they're reliable at producing something that looks like beliefs, such as, I buried this piece of, I buried this worm 2 days ago, I should revisit that, it's going to go bad.
Yeah.
That looks like a proposition. So maybe they don't have the linguistic capacities to really articulate that, but they do have some capacity that is reliable, that allows them to succeed at different tasks, and that looks like it's some kind of knowledge, even if it's not like the full-fledged conceptual knowledge that we...
Sure, okay. Yeah, and they can't relay that to us. Sorry, the train of thought, I see it's still going. But maybe they wouldn't be like justified, but who cares, because they don't have a language in order to for us to ask them anyways? Or would they be justified because of the reliability?
So that's what is interesting about Davidson. So Davidson would say that justification really depends on something like the evidential relation and the support among beliefs.
Yeah.
So he had this view that only beliefs can support other beliefs.
Right, yeah.
That would be incompatible with, if for example, if bees lack that propositional structure of belief, they would not be justified, even though I think Davidson would say they have capacities that are non-trivial. So, for example, since they are attending, let's imagine like the and I think he says something along these lines in that paper, in the Seeing Through Language, that they're not fully justified, but they're communicating. Because what they're doing is, so imagine that there's the waggle dance, and imagine there's two scouts looking at it.
Yeah.
They do have the capacity to what he calls, Davidson called triangulation.
Yes.
So they can triangulate and say, yeah, you mean that orientation, and then they can coordinate.
Yeah.
That is a non-trivial communicative capacity. And maybe, you're right, who cares if they're like fully justified because they don't have beliefs? They can communicate.
Yeah.
And the basis of language is that capacity to triangulate. Plus, for Davidson, the full epistemic justificatory capacity to articulate beliefs in a way that they have a relation of mutual support. Many contemporary philosophers shy away from that commitment to belief. I mean, so many of them would say, no, you know what, the bees have evidence. So you can construct that in a more internalist friendly way. They have evidence that they should go in this direction. That's good evidence.
Yeah.
And they don't need... as long as they're acting on this sort of reason that they have evidence, that's enough to say that there is some kind of cognitive.
They don't need another belief in order to back that to a
exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So my audience is going to want to know some things that we've been talking about for a long time about dogs. So I have to bring this up. I have my dog Theophilus is.
Oh, that's a great name.
Yeah.
He's very cute.
he's like the unofficial mascot, so I always have to ask philosophers about my dog.
Yeah.
Do you think that dogs have beliefs?
I think dogs have definitely something like proto-beliefs. If you think beliefs are explicit, articulate, accessible at a personal level things, maybe dogs don't really have that, because that assumes a lot of non-trivial linguistic machinery.
Right.
But dogs are very sophisticated in terms of emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
So they have reactions to our emotional system that are really finely tuned. Dogs are super interesting because in our evolutionary archaeology, I mean, like when we became humans and we were cohabiting with Neanderthals, there is evidence that humans were already doing something like taming the wolves and turning into a dog. I mean, there's like this evidence of like, footprints of a young, very ancient human in a cave that was also inhabited by Neanderthals, and there's also a footprint of a wolfish-looking dog.
And his best friend goes all the way back.
Yeah, no, it really, and the burial sites. You know, there are burial sites where there's very ancient humans. I mean, these are more recent findings, and people were buried with their dogs or with animals. We have a very strong connection with... We were hunter-gatherers for most of our evolution. Clearly, we bonded with dogs in a way that is very interesting. Also, again, their emotional intelligence. Even if they don't have full-fledged beliefs, they seem to be in tune with us in really interesting ways.
Yeah.
And they're also super intelligent, right? Like they're the way they track features of the environment, if they're in a pack, right? If they're wild, they are very sophisticated hunters. And of course, they derive from wolves,
yeah,
which are among the most interesting collective groups. Yeah.
So some of the discussions that have been happening over the week have mentioned the fact that consciousness and intelligence don't go hand in hand, or don't necessarily go hand in hand. Maybe they can come apart. So I can imagine, you know, a dog being intelligent but not being conscious. But dogs are conscious. Is my dog conscious?
I think so. Okay. Yeah.
Do you think my dog has any degree of self consciousness or self awareness, concept of a self?
Mm-hmm. I would say that dogs probably don't have a very robust narrating sense of self that we have. But they do have a sense of, they have a perspective. So the I mean, probably your dog has a perspective where you are a very important member of his pack. Right?
Yeah.
And the idea is that perspective. So the way I think about the distinction between intelligence and consciousness is, bees and many other creatures with intelligent capacities that may not be conscious, they have capacities to attend to their environment. So attention is something that matters to intelligence in a way that doesn't necessitate consciousness.
When you say attend, I'm thinking like Husserl and stuff like that's popping up. Is that a more robust view than like just perceive? Do you mean something more robust than perceive?
I mean maybe something, if you mean conscious perception, something that could be compatible with unconscious perception,
yeah,
so maybe weaker than full perception.
Okay.
And the idea is that a bee, for example, may not have a full representation of the environment, but is capable of selecting information in a way that information can be used for acting in an intelligent way.
Yeah.
So attention is this selective filtering capacity that can be used for action and cognition without necessitating phenomenal consciousness, which is this non-trivial perspective on the world.
So you can attend without phenomenal consciousness?
At least experimentally, there's evidence that you can. There's the cases of blind sight that people
talk about
in the literature.
Sure.
But also conceivably, there's at least possibilities where other animals can attend to the environment in ways that don't necessitate the kind of phenomenal conscious perspective that we have.
So that seems like that would be evidence for the possibility of philosophical zombies.
It's evidence for partial philosophical zombies,
okay,
or at least conceivably.
Conceivably.
You can think of, I think Net Block has this thought experiment of the super duper blindsider, which is like a zombie because there's nothing it is like exactly to be this super duper blindsider, but the cognition is still there, the capacities to attend are in principle still there. So, I mean, these are probably our cognition is not the kind of cognition where you can completely separate the phenomenal consciousness from attention.
Sure.
But that, I think that possibility opens up,
yeah,
if you think about definitely artificial intelligence,
yeah,
it opens up across the animal kingdom. And you can think of animals like dogs who definitely have a perspective that it is something it is like to be done.
Yeah.
And it's a very interesting thing. It's phenomenally rich for them. It involves emotions and so on. They may not have language, but they have that on top of their attentive capacities. While there are other species like insects that may only have attentive capacities without this robust sense of like what is it like to be done.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's helpful. A really good point that you brought up yesterday in your talk was that we get really excited when we think about AI and AGI and should start tossing rights and stuff like that. When a lot of the animals that we do think are phenomenally conscious, we just step on them or whatever. We don't make any laws for them.
Yeah.
When it comes to rights and stuff like that, what's the connection between, maybe it's like a legal connection. Legal is not as fun for me, but in attributing rights and moral status of
mm-hmm.
some kind to an animal, how important is the phenomenal consciousness
mm-hmm.
question?
Yeah, that's a really tricky question, a very good question. I do think there's this funny asymmetry, and I'm glad you bring this up, that we want to throw literally billions of dollars to the development of a technology that many of us, or at least some engineers think may become conscious and then start like hiring lawyers for them and stuff. While we do know, or at least there's incredibly good evidence that many animals are conscious. They're conscious in ways that are very similar to us. These involve the higher mammals, you know, the apes, the great apes, the dogs, many mammals at least. And it's a very interesting question, which other animals? Yeah. And so people that are interested in doing that, so for example, there's a recent paper about crustaceans being conscious. The idea is, we need to be real, we need to be responsible about the moral standing of these animals, because for moral standing, being conscious matters, right? So it matters in different theories, but it really matters in the utilitarian theory, where what makes you a member of the moral community is the fact that you can suffer.
Yeah.
And that suffering is something that you experience through your phenomenal consciousness. Yeah. And so that gives you a standing, and so these folks won't say, oh, look, these animals have moral standing. Now, what I'm trying to say yesterday is, it's funny that we try to do that with AI, but also it's interesting that we're confusing the legal question with the moral question.
Yeah.
Because even if animals were not conscious, we could still protect them on other grounds. We protect corporations not because they're sentient. We protect them on different grounds.
Yeah.
So we protect them because they're kind of autonomous agents with their own resources, and they create goods, they sell goods, and they need protection to do that effectively.
Yeah.
So I think
we talk about forests, you know, off air. We talk about, you know, certain rivers being protected and such like that.
Exactly. So we need to protect the conditions that animals require, including the protection of forests, rivers, etc., so that we can effectively protect them, and that requires legislation. And we tend to be more willing to project these capacities for consciousness and protection to AI systems than animals, many animals. So how we're gonna protect the environment through the law is really interesting, but one important thing is we don't need to think of forests as conscious. We can just think of them as, you know, the kind of, you know, interesting structures that are sort of autonomous, and we want to protect them the way we protect banks. You know, like,
yeah, right. Yeah, that's such a good point. I wonder if we care more about AI because we think that they're going to be like us and they can suffer in a way like us, whereas a crustacean, I don't know, like, you just want to eat the lobster, so you don't really think about it, I guess. But
yeah,
There's been some. So I studied philosophy of religion, and a problem in philosophy of religion is the problem of animal suffering.
Mm-hmm.
It's a particularized problem of evil. And some responses to that have said that animals don't suffer. They can feel pain, but they don't suffer because suffer might require, like, reflecting on your pain. Is there anything like that going on in the animal consciousness literature about whether or not animals can suffer? And it's probably a technical sense of suffering, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not familiar with the literature enough to know.
Yeah, so many people think that it depends on your, as you said, if suffering is some kind of conceptual state or some kind of judgment.
Sure.
And if you have a view of emotions, according to which emotions are some kind of representational state that looks a lot like a judgment,
yeah,
then animals won't be able to have that kind of cognition. I would say that most people working on animal cognition, what they would do is see what are the main, this is what people did, for example, in the crustacean paper. What are the main signatures of suffering, or intense pain in humans and other close to human animal? Behavioral markers, neural markers.
Yeah.
See how much of that you get in other species. And the idea is, maybe you don't get the whole thing we call suffering, but, or the sophisticated concept of suffering, which in our, the big concept seems to also be culturally dependent.
And, yeah.
But you do get the sort of the basis for the judgment, sort of like the important aspects of the experience that then we use to conceptualize suffering. You get those in many animals.
Yeah.
And so the idea is, probably with babies, you know, babies don't have really the whole conception of suffering.
Yeah, right.
But maybe they do have some kind of suffering that is very close to animal suffering.
Yeah.
And we do protect babies.
Yeah.
And so we probably, if, I mean, if that's the reason why we protect babies, there are very, very strong reasons to protect animals.
That's a fantastic point, especially pushing it back on babies.
Yeah.
I can see no one would probably want to do this actively, but if you said, like, well, animals don't suffer, so therefore I can burn the beaks off my chickens or whatever, mm-hmm. no problem. And you just go right back to the babies and say, well, can you burn the toes off of the baby? Because it's not going to suffer in the same way as the technical center. Well, of course, it's going to feel pain, and in at least the folk conception of suffering, it's going to suffer. So don't do that to your chickens.
Yes.
That's fascinating. I love when you can pull it back like that. That's really, really good. You brought up phenomenal needs and epistemic needs in non-linguistic animals that have consciousness. Can you broach those two topics for the audience?
Sure, yeah. So that's based on this recent book that I just published on AI.
Which is open source, right?
It's open source, okay. Yeah.
I'll put the link in the description. I'll see you now.
Awesome.
Yeah. So everyone, you can find that open source book in the description, wherever you get this podcast at.
Thanks so much. Yeah, so thanks. So this is a distinction between the phenomenal needs and the epistemic needs that I discussed in my recent book on AI, which is open access. And the idea there is, if you have a system that behaves a lot externally like us, right, like responds to questions, and looks like, I mean, like a perfect version of ChatGPT, you still have the problem that to call really that system intelligent, generally intelligent, you need to ask what exactly is happening behind the scenes. What kinds of needs is the system representing? What kinds of needs the system has? And one way of looking at the alignment problem is, we do have these two sets of needs that come from very different perspectives. One I call the epistemic needs perspective. These are needs that many animals that may not be conscious have. So bees are a good example.
Yeah.
These are representational needs, cognitive needs to track objects in the environment, some very basic capacities to memorize events, motor control systems that work, you need to use that to navigate, accuracy conditions, things like that. Those are epistemic needs that have to do with how you as a knower can know certain things about your environment.
Yeah.
And then there's these other needs that come with the perspective of what is it like to be you. And I call them phenomenal needs because they require things like experiencing empathy, social bonding, the need to care and feel cared. So these are needs that mammals definitely have.
Bees don't necessarily have.
Bees probably don't have them. And then we have these very unique, non-trivial, phenomenal needs that have to do with moral and aesthetic experiences.
Yeah.
And aesthetic experiences play a very big role in the lives of humans. And humans do, you know, go through a lot of sacrifices to become an artist or be artistic or appreciate art. And of course, there's no epistemic calculation behind that. Those are just different kinds of needs. And one thing that I discussed in the book is that in many ways, those needs, I mean, so for example, Maslow, who is this psychologist, Abraham Maslow, thought of these needs, what I'm calling the phenomenal needs that have to do with these transcendental needs, like the aesthetic needs, or spiritual needs.
Yeah.
He said those.
Transcendental, that's a great word on the podcast. It's good.
Yeah. So transcendental needs, according to Maslow, are at the very top of the human set of needs, and that's why people do sacrifice many things for their faith and their religious convictions, and they try to live a life where they can have religious experiences. And they live a life where they can have a beautiful, meaningful life where they can have aesthetic experiences.
Yeah. So going back on to suffering, which we talked a little bit, suffering maybe is like the anti of a need. It's like you have a need not to suffer, you don't want to suffer. Would suffering fall under epistemic needs or phenomenal needs?
That's very interesting. So I think some animals avoid suffering, so let's think about insects, by detecting bodily damage without much of a experience that, you know, like, it would feel bad to them.
Like bees, do you think bees?
I think bees avoid harm without really experiencing something like we experience. Right?
Okay.
Our experience of suffering is very complex, so we can experience suffering by seeing someone else suffer.
Oh, yeah.
And we also experience suffering when we undergo bodily damage, but under many, many other conditions. We experience very intense suffering when we grieve. The phenomenal need to avoid suffering is much more complex than the mere epistemic detection of bodily damage, right? So, and you can think of extreme cases where you actually don't care that much about whether your body is going to be damaged because you want to save someone who's suffering.
Yeah.
And that your suffering, in a way, would be bigger if you didn't help them.
You came up with such a good example about saving someone else. I was thinking, I do jiu-jitsu and wrestling.
Uh-huh.
I was thinking about when you're in a submission and you're going to let, you don't care about suffering, you're going to let it break because you'd rather win. But your example's much better because it's about someone else.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're both examples. Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, but it's interesting to think about. Yeah, you can detect what is making you suffer.
Yeah.
And you can avoid that.
Yeah.
Another thing is to avoid that because of your suffering and because of your experiencing of suffering.
Oh, yeah.
And because that experience feels really bad to you. And that experience is not necessarily tied to whether or not you're detecting bodily damage.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. So I wonder if it crosses categories where they're suffering, like, between your P needs and your E needs, your epistemic and phenomenological needs. Do you think that there's like two avoidance behaviors, and maybe the bees don't have the phenomenal one, but like humans have both? Does that make sense, or do we only have? Do you think maybe ours is just the phenomenal?
No, it makes total sense. So some people are born, and this is something I discussed in previous work. But some people are born with a genetic condition. I'm not going to remember the name of the disease, but it is a condition where you cannot experience pain. What we call the experience of pain that has to do with bodily harm. There's a term about the phenomenology.
Yeah.
I think it's called nosological pain, but. So we know that we're in pain because we feel it immediately. Now, these people that are born with this condition, they learn how to avoid pain. They know that pain is bad. They just don't feel it. And many of them live short lives because it's hard for them.
You get a cut on their foot and they don't know it and gets infected.
Yeah, I mean, when they're a very dramatic case, like a girl, you know, has this condition, something falls on a boiling pot of water, they would reach for it.
Yeah.
And you know, like then someone's like, "What are you doing?" And
right.
They would not feel it, but they learn that it's bad. So they have if you want to put it, this is a very extreme case, but and I will talk about a different, not as extreme case in a second. But you can think of these people as satisfying the needs of avoiding harm through epistemic.
Gotcha.
So they have to represent the condition. Some of them have to learn how to react to pain so that others don't freak out.
Oh, sure.
Because it freaks out people. So, for example, I'm not looking, and like I'm one of these people, and something just goes across my arm.
Yeah.
And I would still be talking to you, and you'd be like, "Oh my god!" Like,
yeah.
We need to call 911. And so they learn
yeah.
that this freaks people out, and
yeah.
they learn not to say, "Oh, ouch, ouch, ouch."
Are they pretending, or does it become so much part of who they are that they're habituated, where they actually are reacting?
It's super interesting that they do it because of other people.
Wow.
But I don't think it's because they feel anything.
Gotcha.
So, but then that's very alien to us, right? Like that's one thing I think is interesting that I also mentioned in the book, is that this perspective gives a perspective of familiarity. We're familiar with pain because we experience things that are bad for us. Pain for these folks is kind of unfamiliar.
Yeah.
They need to learn it through representations. And another case that is very familiar to the philosophical literature is Mary. Right? So Mary learns what is it like to see red. Before that, she's a very good epistemic agent.
Yeah.
She has epistemic needs about color,
yes,
like detecting
yes.
red. But once she learns red, she has new needs. And one of the new needs is, you know, red kind of looks nice in a sunset, right? So those needs of like experiencing red in those contexts where you're getting an experience that is not just epistemically reducible,
yeah.
or at least in principle, it's a different kind of thing, right? Like an experience of beauty, of the beauty of a sunset is not just like, oh yeah, it's, you know, 6:30, it should be sunset, and I'm representing that accurately, right? So,
even though it needs, like, maybe red becomes her favorite color, and she wants to wear red dresses instead of blue dresses or something.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
And it will play a different role in her life
yeah.
than this previous knowledge that she has. Yeah.
That's fascinating. If you guys want to hear more about Mary, Frank Jackson's been on the podcast to talk about Mary, though unfortunately he bailed on the Mary experiment and became a physicalist himself. But Carlos, thanks so much for coming to the podcast. This was like just a shotgun approach to just like get a bunch of your ideas out there. I'd love to have you back on to go more in depth on, you've written so much, you've done so much work on certain areas. So please come back on.
I would love to be back on, and talk more about, what's the name of your dog?
Oh, Theophilus.
Theophilus, yeah. Theophilus, yeah.
So if the audience wants to find out more from you and get more of your stuff, where can they find you at?
So I teach at San Francisco State. I do have a website. It's my name, carlosmontemillo.org.
Okay.
There's a website for the book where you can download the PDF. And I would love to respond to your audience questions through email. And I would love to be back.
Awesome. Yeah. Fantastic. All right. Well, folks, you can find the links in the description, wherever you're getting this at, to Dr. Montemayor's .org page and to the book. So go check that out. That's going to have to do it for now. This has been Parker's Pensies, and as always, all glory to God.